Being from the South, I know a thing or two about how bugs can ruin a great outdoor experience. It's crazy how something so small can affect some of the potentially greatest experiences of your life. And that's why today's show is brought to you in part by Sawyer. You might know them as the water filter company. I actually have a couple Sawyer filters, but they make a lot of other great products too, including their insect repellent. And just some points about what it is. It's great for the whole family. It's actually safe to use on infants and those who are pregnant because they don't use DEET, the active ingredient. They use something better called picaridin. It actually lasts longer. It lasts up to 12 hours. Pretty incredible. And it doesn't damage any of your gear. So it's insect repellent specifically made for families who are also outdoorsy because it won't ruin any of that high dollar gear that you've bought to be out there. And it does a fantastic job of protecting you and your family from those vector-borne illnesses that are carried by insects. I know for me, I'm always carrying some insect repellent because I've had mosquitoes specifically ruin some pretty incredible backpacking experiences. Don't let it happen to you. Use Sawyer's 20% picaridin insect repellents. Find out more about that at sawyer.com. Play safe, travel safely. Sawyer, they keep you outdoors.
But you know, the biggest difference is, and that I was told this over and over again by the climbers, biggest difference between those times and now is the weather forecasting. Because back then, the forecasting was kind of dated and inaccurate.
This is the Adventure Sports Podcast, where we hear stories of adventure from every corner of the planet. We interview all sorts of folks who are using their sport to explore the world around them and give you the inspiration you need to get out there and have some fun. So today's episode is about climbing 8,000 meter peaks in the wintertime. And the 8,000ers are the biggest mountains in the world. There's only 14 of them. They're all in the Himalayas. And it was crazy enough to climb them in the first place, in my opinion. It's even crazier to do them in the wintertime. And so Bernadette wrote an entire book going into the history, traveling all over the world, doing interviews, with the people who have done them, with their family members, and just getting the story behind why people did this and what happened, how did it go about. And as you'll hear, the challenge is not yet complete. So if there's any aspiring mountaineers now out there, you can really make a name for yourself by going after one of these peaks in the winter. So a little bit more about Bernadette. She joined us today from Banff. And yeah, she's just incredible. She spent 20 years volunteering at the Banff Mountain Film Festival. She's the founder of the Banff Center for Mountain Culture. And if you don't know where Banff is, it's in Alberta, Canada, and it's a beautiful mountain town in the Canadian Rocky Mountains. I encourage you to look it up. One of my favorite places in the world. But that is just a snippet of Bernadette's kind of accolade. She's written about a dozen or so books now, all about mountaineering, and she has received just tons of awards from the American Alpine Club, the Explorers Club, and just many, many more. But thank you again, Bernadette, for joining us, and I hope you enjoy this episode. All right, folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Mason Gravely, and today we're talking to Bernadette McDonald. Bernadette, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for joining. You know, we're going to be talking about your book. Folks heard a little bit about you in the show's intro, but I'd love to, so we know we're going to be talking about your book, Winter 8000. Talking about the 8,000 meter peaks all around the world that folks are climbing in the wintertime. But I would love to go all the way back, if you don't mind, and hear about, you know, where did you grow up? I know you have a career in the outdoors and in mountaineering and writing about it. You know, where did this start for you? Have you always been into this, or did you grow up somewhere far from that world?
Yeah, I grew up definitely far from that world. I grew up on a farm in Saskatchewan, and yeah, it was pretty flat, actually. The first time I ever saw the mountains was when I was 11 years old. We went on a family winter vacation. Here comes the winter theme. But being a farm, that's when my dad had time off. So that's when we went on our trips. And this particular trip was to British Columbia. And of course, we traveled through the Rocky Mountains and the Selkirk Mountains. And I can honestly say that I knew immediately that the mountains spoke to me. It's where I wanted to spend my life. I had no clue how that was going to happen. But it was just a landscape that really resonated for me. But in the meantime, I had to go back to the farm.
What about it do you think drew you in so young and so immediately? Was it just the distinction between there and home? What were you feeling, you think, at 11 years old?
You know, I remember feeling, sounds ridiculous, but I remember feeling cozy because in Saskatchewan, I mean, where we lived was really quite flat. And, you know, there was a lot of space and, I mean, it's beautiful in its own way. You feel kind of exposed, I guess, in a way, because it's just you on this flat landscape and, you know, all the elements are, you know, if there are elements such as wind or snow or sleet or whatever, you know, has full access to you. And when I first, you know, spent some time walking around and just, you know, the first night sleeping in the mountains, it felt, you know, it was in the bottom of a deep valley. There were big peaks surrounding. It was actually in the town of Banff, which I eventually moved to. But yeah, it felt contained and cozy and just right.
Yeah, what a place to fall in love with the mountains, first of all. I mean, does it get better than the Canadian Rockies? I mean, and especially Banff, of all places. Between 11 years old and when you eventually made it back out, were you able to see it very often before you were out on your own?
You know, I had relatives in British Columbia, so we would come visit them periodically. And then when I was 16, I enrolled in university at Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington. And you know, I had the opportunity to go into the Cascades and learned how to ski and you know, hike and that kind of thing. So I guess from the age of 16, I started to have the opportunity to actually go into the mountains and do stuff, not just sort of drive through them and sort of wonder what it would be like.
Is there this pull out west in Canada like it is in the U.S.? You know, I just feel that there's this, like, you know, go west kind of feeling as you start coming of age. Is that similar in Canada?
Oh, it certainly is, particularly for people who are from what I would call central Canada, let's say Ontario or Quebec. Now, Saskatchewan is considered Western Canada, but I think for someone from the prairies, it's more about, you know, getting out to the mountains because we're already from the West. But like my husband is from Ontario. And when he came west, he was 18. And yeah, that was a real sort of migratory thing. You know, you've got to go out west and, you know, experience, you know, the wildness, the, you know, just skiing and, I don't know, partying, I suppose, is probably what he did.
That's wonderful. And I know for years, you volunteered with the Banff Mountain Film Festival in eventually started the Mountain Culture Division at the Banff Center. Can you talk about your involvement, how you got involved with the film festival and what that experience was like over two decades?
Well, I was working at the time at the Banff Center, which is a cultural institution, you know, an advanced learning institution. And I was working in the music department because actually that's what I was trained to be, was a musician. So I was working in the music department, but at this time, I was already married to my husband, who was a national park warden. And we did actually a lot of stuff in the mountains. We hiked, we climbed, we paddled, we did horse trips, you know, for 17 and 24 days at a time with, you know, two riding horses and two pack horses. So we were pretty pretty connected with the mountain landscape and the mountain lifestyle. So while I was happy to work in the music department at the Banff Center, I also knew about the film festival because we would attend once a year. And I just sort of wandered over one day and asked if they needed any volunteers. And of course, what festival doesn't? And yeah, that just sort of morphed into, you know, a career with the festival. As sometimes happens, what you're trained to do becomes your hobby, and what you were never trained to do becomes your profession. And that's what happened to me. So I, within a couple of years, I was the director of the festival, and then, you know, things started to evolve. We started the book festival and the world tour, and all that stuff just grew as time went on. And eventually it became the Center for Mountain Culture.
Music and film you were getting involved in. When did writing start to become part of your life?
Well, writing was, yeah, that was also unplanned. Writing was just part of my job, really, as, you know, working with the festival. There was just a lot of stuff that had to be written, you know, for promotional purposes, for all kinds of reasons. But, and then in the year 2000, we wanted to celebrate 25 years of the film festival and did this huge event. It was called Banff Mountain Summit, where we invited, I think it was 32 of the most, you know, famous speakers and guests that had been to the festival in the previous 25 years to all show up at once and do lectures on certain topics that amazingly they accepted from me. But part of our big plan for that year was to do a book. National Geographic was one of the partners of the festival at the time, and they had a book division, quite a new book division, and they were keen to do this book, which was a series of essays by these 32 famous mountain personalities. I mean, everybody from Sir Edmund Hillary to Reinhold Messner, Todd Skinner, Jack Tattle, Lynn Hill. I mean, everybody was in that book. And my job was to edit those pieces and also to put the whole thing together and write the history of the festival. So that was the first sort of writing experience, which, you know, now when I think back on it, it was kind of jumping into a really big fire.
Big fire in a good way. Turned over and maybe an untapped talent maybe you didn't know you had.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, well, I mean, obviously I read a lot. I mean, you know, you do, or mm-hmm. I did. But, you know, I think you have probably some talent, but I suspect it was more just hard work.
You know, I hear that a lot about writing. You know, there's people dealing with writer's block and, you know, maybe outlining. And I heard an author say recently, you know, a lot of authors don't realize, or aspiring authors don't realize, a lot of times it just comes down to sitting down and writing. Just writing and writing and writing to get it out, because you kind of, a lot of people don't enjoy that part of it, and that becomes so much of what you're actually doing. I don't know, maybe you experience that too, maybe not.
Absolutely. The you're right. I mean, the most important thing is to just start. I mean, obviously if you're writing nonfiction, you have to do a whole lot of research. So that's, I suppose, the real beginning. But once you're well into the research, you have to start writing. And the first draft, I think, is just miserable. It's just a really tough job to do. And it's always bad, at least in my case. You know, it doesn't read well. It's disjointed and this, that, and the other thing. But, you know, you get those first 50,000, 70,000, whatever words down. And yeah, you start to feel a little more confident, and you start to see a shape and a direction.
Was there ever a time that you made a decision to gravitate towards writing instead of film, being involved with the film festival for so long?
Yeah, absolutely. What happened was, I think it was, well, I guess it must have been in my 19th year with the festival. And I was already pretty involved with writing. I mean, I had edited several books and, you know, written parts of them. And I had written biographies. I guess I had written one biography of Elizabeth Hawley. And then I was in the middle of writing the story of Dr. Charles Houston, American mountaineer and high altitude doctor. And then I was offered a contract from a really, you know, important publishing house in England to write the biography of Tomáš Humar, the Slovenian climber. And so basically I had two books on the go plus a very full-time job. And I don't know, it just seemed to me that 20 years, I was approaching 20 years with the festival, and maybe it was time for some new blood, some younger blood. And I had these great writing opportunities and I was really loving it. So, you know, maybe it's just time for the next chapter.
Oh man, that's so exciting. You know, and I think you would probably say it was a good direction to go for you, because you ended up, you know, so far 11 books in, a surrounding story, you know, about stories in the mountaineering world. You know, I mean, has it been a direction you've been happy with?
I've enjoyed it immensely. I mean, it was really difficult to leave the festival. You know, that was an exciting job. I had just the most amazing team of people that I worked with, and we were tight. We were really close, friends as well as colleagues. And that was sort of heartbreaking, actually, to leave them. But I mean, it's a small town. We, you know, we see each other, socialize and go skiing and stuff. So that was really hard to do. And, you know, writing, although parts of writing are, you know, social, because when you're doing the research and so on, but a lot of it is by yourself. And that was a bit of an adjustment. But overall, I think it was absolutely the right thing to do. I think it was the right thing to do for the festival, too, because, you know, a creative event such as a festival or any kind of an arts organization, I think it does actually benefit when the leadership at the top, you know, has some new blood from time to time, just new ideas, new approaches. And I really, I'm glad that happened for the festival, because I think it was time.
Well, it's still, you know, obviously a festival that highly acclaimed. It's definitely something if you are able to premiere a film there, for sure. So, you know, someone's doing something right, because I hear about it every year. And even this year, you know, I know it was having to be virtual, but
I know.
Yeah, I'm sure. I know. So many festivals, so many great things were pushed virtual. And, you know, it's sad, but sometimes that opens it up to a crowd that couldn't see it before.
Yeah, well, who knows, hey? Who knows what's going to happen with this virtual festival? I mean, where I've got my fingers crossed like crazy that it goes well. And I know I've seen the program and it's good. It's a really good program. So,
well, tell us about your newest project, your newest book, Winter 8000. Just if someone isn't familiar with the concept of an 8000 meter peak, or just kind of the premise of the book, if you don't mind.
Yeah, no problem. Okay, so there are 14 8000 meter peaks in the world. They are all in Pakistan and Nepal and Tibet, and they're in the two mountain ranges, the Himalaya and the Karakoram. All of the 8,000 meter peaks had been climbed before any of them had been climbed in winter. I mean, basically, nobody even considered going to them in winter, because the conditions in the other seasons, the spring, the fall season, and in the Karakoram, the summer, were plenty difficult and horrendous enough to provide enough challenge for most climbers. But the Polish alpinists, who made a huge name for themselves in the highest mountains on Earth, were kind of behind the eight ball compared to most other countries, because while all the 8,000 meter peaks had been climbed for the first time, the Polish climbers were kind of stuck at home just because of the communist regime that followed the Second World War. So it was a frustrating time for them, because they were very skilled, very strong, highly trained climbers, and they wanted to get out there in the big mountains. So when things loosened up a bit in Poland, and they were able to start climbing abroad, this was one of the things that they considered doing as something new, something different, something that would help them to make a name for themselves in the high mountains. First of all, they went to Afghanistan to the Hindu Kush, and climbed in the winter up to say 7,000 and higher meters, and then it was off to the Himalaya. So they were really the ones that started the whole concept of winter climbing at high altitude. And it was kind of a specialized way of climbing. It had to do with, colder temperatures, higher winds, long nights, short days, all the things that you think of about winter, but just accentuated incredibly because of the high altitude.
Yeah, so every aspect of mountaineering just harder is what it sounds like.
That's right. Well, one of the Polish climbers who actually wasn't a winter specialist at all referred to it as the art of suffering.
So mountaineering can be suffering as it is. So that is just magnified. So let me ask you this. What drew you to this story and going back to, why people were climbing 8,000 meter peaks in the winter, or how that idea started? How did you hear about the story and what drew you into it?
Well, it actually, for me, it started, I think it was in 1994. Anyway, long time ago, I was in Poland at a party. It was a post-festival party. And the reason I was there is that I'd helped organize the festival. And at this gathering, it was a bunch of climbers, primarily, at the local clubhouse in Katowice, Poland. And that's when I first learned about this sort of specialty, this winter high altitude climbing specialty, because, the room was full of them, basically. They were famous climbers in their own right, just because of their high altitude experience. But I had not realized up to that point how this group of people had specialized in winter and how they had set themselves apart from other high altitude climbers by focusing on winter. And one of the people at the party was a fellow named Andrzej Zawada, his last name Zawada. And he was the mastermind of all this stuff. He was an expedition leader, very well respected, had first come up with the idea of taking climbers to the high mountains in winter. And I was intrigued, first of all, by him, by his ability to mobilize a group of people to go and suffer like that. And I was intrigued with the climbers who actually were up to it and keen to do it. What were their reasons for it? Were they masochists? Were they just looking for extra challenge? And there were all kinds of reasons, but I just became really fascinated by this group of people. And as I said, the whole concept started in Poland. And then as I actually started researching winter climbing at high altitude, I realized there were people from all over the world.
So what do you think, is it just that frustration you were talking about with being under a communist regime that led to this kind of groundswell of talent coming out of Poland, of drive coming out of Poland to climb these peaks in winter? Or do you see it was just an opportunity to do something that hadn't been done by this one climber, and then that climber mobilizing a group to essentially climb these peaks in a way that hasn't been done before?
I think it's a combination. Winter climbing in Poland, the mountain range in Poland is the Tatras, and it forms the boundary with Slovakia. Winter climbing is super popular in both countries. And again, I tried to find out why. I mean, now, of course, winter climbing, ice climbing, technical ice climbing is super popular everywhere. But back then, it was not that at all. It was just winter mountaineering. And what I learned was that, again, going back to the restrictions that they were living under, they could not travel to the Alps and do alpine climbs on, glacial ice. They didn't have that opportunity in those years. So they perfected their sort of ice climbing techniques by climbing in winter. The mountains in Poland aren't high as the Alps, but in winter they're pretty severe. And so it was, it was something that they could do that approximated climbing in the higher mountains. And as they got better at it and then became really good at it, of course, the visionary of the group, Andrzej Zawada, realized, aha, he was an ambitious man. This is a way for Polish climbers to set themselves apart from the rest of mountaineering.
And obviously, when you find a niche like that, or kind of a way to do things differently that might bring you some attention and creates this this honor, this thing you can be proud of, you start getting the idea to try to do them all. Did the team, the Polish team, start to want to do more and more? Was that the goal, or what was the goal of their mission?
You know, I don't think initially the goal was to do them all, but certainly the goal was to do a lot of them. And, once they had, so the very first one that they tried was Lhotse, the first 8,000ers. They did not reach the summit, but they did break the 8,000 meter barrier. And that was, in some ways it was a failure, obviously, but in another way, it was mind-blowing, because they realized they could climb above 8,000 meters in the coldest season. And in storms, in the cold temperatures, in the wind. And when they actually went back for their next attempt of an 8,000er, which was Everest, seemed a little overly ambitious, but they succeeded.
So Everest was the first 8,000-meter peak to be climbed in winter.
That's right.
Wow.
Strangely enough.
Is that just because it's Everest?
Well, I suppose Andrzej Zawada was ambitious enough to think, let's go
for the biggest one first.
Go for it, yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah. Wow. When was this? What year was this? And what was kind of the response to the climbing in mountaineering community? Was it, did it make waves? Was it quieter than expected? What how was it accepted?
Oh, it made huge waves. It was the winter of 79-80, and it was, they barely squeezed it in. In fact, they had to ask for a slight extension, a 2-day extension of their permit in order to pull it off. But yeah, there was a huge response all over the world, both from climbers and actually non-climbers. I mean, the Pope sent them a letter. There was obviously interest in it, because Reinhold Messner actually disputed the ascent for a while, saying that since they had started. Oh, no, let me just think about what his reason was. There was some reason that he said that it didn't fit into the proper category of winter, because in Nepal at the time, the winter season ended at the end of January, and this ascent took place in the middle of February. But later on, the Nepalese authorities said, no, we recognize it, we authorize it, it is a winter ascent. So there was a lot of interest, and it was, kind of an astonishing thing that they did. And the very next 8,000er to be climbed was just 3 years later, and it was also by a Polish team.
Wow, I didn't realize just how early that was. The 79 and 80, obviously not pretty recent by all accounts, but also, on the cusp of a lot of technology then as well. So that had to just be nuts to so many people. Can you tell us a little bit about, because I don't want you to give too much of the book away, but what are some of the big differences that you've seen with climbing one of these mountains in the wintertime? I know we're all familiar with what it looks like to climb Everest. We've seen pictures and kind of what people are outfitted with, and oxygen tanks and big parkas and those snowsuits. What are there any major differences with climbing in the winter?
Well, there are differences. I think actually the biggest differences are between what it was like in 1979-80 and what it's like now. Huge differences. I mean, well, particularly for teams that were coming out of Poland, because their budgets were they weren't that big, and they didn't have easy access to really good technical equipment. So they were kind of making it up as they went. They were going to local boot makers and asking them to make boots that would withstand cold temperatures. And they had welding goggles instead of sunglasses. And, you know, they had cotton tents and stuff like this. It was, when you see the pictures, it's hard to believe that they actually pulled it off. And the two that went to the summit actually both came back, and with not much frostbite, you know, all things considered. But, you know, the biggest difference is, and that I was told this over and over again by the climbers, biggest difference between those times and now is the weather forecasting. Because back then, the forecasting was just kind of dated and inaccurate. And now the forecasts are incredibly accurate and, you know, very specific up to the hour. They can determine whether or not there'll be a 4-hour break in the wind, or, you know, a 6-hour break, and when it'll start. And you know, they can predict actually what the wind speeds are and temperatures and all this stuff. So, you know, when the climbers are at base camp and they're starting to consider a summit bid, they can really target their movement up to a high camp so that they're poised, you know, at a certain hour of a certain day, knowing full well that they have a window of so many hours. And that just didn't exist back in the day.
So technology has gotten better all around, from the gear to monitoring weather, to just expertise in learning from past generations. But even despite that, there is still frontiers to be climbed in the world of 8,000 meter peaks in the wintertime. There's one left, K2.
And it's not from lack of trying.
Yeah, exactly. So what did you learn about that mountain, and maybe why it hasn't been climbed, and what were some of the frustrations that teams met along the way specific to that one? Because the fact that it's, you know, this challenge has been started, you know, 40 years ago, still isn't completely complete. That has to be, you know, there have to be some mountaineers out there salivating at the chance.
Yeah, there are, and there have been, and there will be. And there, some of them are the very best, as particularly in winter mountaineering at high altitude, but just in mountaineering in general at high altitude. For example, Denis Arubko, the Russian, who has been on two K2 winter expeditions and has made a number of other first winter ascents of 8,000ers, is, you know, just as a couple of weeks ago said he would like to go back, even though last year he said he was retiring from high altitude climbing, but it sounds like maybe not if he had a chance again at K2 in winter. But most of the people and most of the expeditions that went to K2 in winter were turned back by storms. I mean, it's obviously K2 is a very difficult mountain in whatever season. And so that adds to the difficulty of climbing it in winter too. But what most people told me was that it was just the weather, because where K2 is situated in the Karakoram, it's quite far north. It's colder and the winds are incredibly strong, and they're basically, they just wipe people. They wipe tents, entire camps off the mountain. And, That's what they really struggle with, is the wind.
I can only imagine. I mean, do these expeditions interest you personally? I had a lot of researching you. You hear a lot about your work, but I don't hear a lot about what you like to do. Are you a mountaineer yourself?
Oh, I am so incredibly not interested in high altitude climbing in winter.
Okay.
No. Absolutely not.
So let me ask you this: Why did you write so extensively about something you don't really have an interest in doing yourself?
Well, I mean, I have a very strong interest in mountaineering and mountaineering history. I mean, I've done some mountaineering just with my husband and with my friends and whatnot, and I like to rock climb. I think through all those years of working at the festival and getting to know a lot of mountaineers from different parts of the world, and, you know, starting to maybe understand a little bit what makes them tick, it interests me, and I like history, and I, it just, seems like a natural thing to be drawn to and to write about.
So with interviewing, I mean, it's just very fascinating, you know, that it's not the same, but like I'll go home and visit my mom and she'll cook something for dinner that she has no interest in eating. And I'm like, why did you do that? You know what I mean? Like, why didn't you make something we all wanted together? But it's just something she enjoys doing. For you and for me, I mean, I guess when I look at this, I love interviewing folks like you and folks that do these things. And there's half the interviews, it's sports that I'm like, I have no interest in doing that myself. But obviously the way the brain works and the way these people work is obviously very fascinating. After interviewing so many of these athletes and talking to their families, talking to their friends, talking to this community, what do you think was maybe some of the most common themes of these people who not only want to do these mountains, but do them in under such difficult circumstances? Was there any personality themes that started to become apparent?
Yeah, there were, you know, quite a few, and of course it varies greatly. Some of the climbers who focused on winter were and still continue to do it because it's it does distinguish them from other climbers. I mean, it is a really hardcore thing to do, and if you can do a first ascent of an 8,000er in winter, there's no question it is good for your career. It is good for your resume. And so there's a certain amount of that involved. In some cases, and actually in most cases, what I heard was there's a certain beauty to be in the high mountains in winter that you can't get in any other season simply because there's nobody else there. As your listeners, I'm sure know, the high mountains are getting crowded for all kinds of reasons, guided trips and, it's just getting very, very crowded in the summer or in the spring and fall seasons. And that's not the case in the winter. Now, there was an exception, particularly on Nanga Parbat, for a couple of years because the race just, grew in intensity and popularity, I suppose, and it got a little bit crowded there. But in most cases, there's one expedition. And so you have this incredible landscape, the most amazing mountains on earth, and you're there with your team and that's it. And they all speak about that, that loneliness, that incredible feeling of being out there on the edge of the earth.
I've seen it on just a small scale, everything from visiting a national park to just going for a hike somewhere, in the wintertime. It can be that experience of isolation, that wilderness experience we're all looking for. And I'm sure on some of those peaks, it's just like being on the moon,
Yeah.
Just as harsh and just as...
Yeah, I've heard that expression wow. from them. It was like being on another planet.
I can only imagine. I it's so far from the world we're used to. I'm sure that's exactly what it feels like. So, you got to interview a lot of these families as well, a lot of the children of climbers that were lost and spouses or partners. Did you see any trends or any sort of, I don't know, any sort of similar personality traits with folks that are related to these climbers or have to deal with them? Is it just a certain type of person that works this way, is what I'm getting at?
Yeah, one of the things that became clear to me, and it's not just with the characters in this book, but in a number of the characters that I've gotten to know over the years, who do this kind of thing, they're amazing people. They're incredibly talented. They're very strong. They're well trained. They're motivated and focused and all kinds of things. And sometimes what we forget about is that they almost always have a support system. It varies, but there are almost always people around them who care about them and who, support them emotionally or intellectually or financially. and help them become these amazing people that they are and do these, you know, horrendously difficult things that they do. And I guess one of the, if there is a common theme amongst the people that I talked to who were either spouses or in some cases children, is that they didn't always understand why their partners or their fathers felt so compelled to leave them all the time and go to the mountains and climb, particularly in winter and particularly in the early years, they'd be going for like a couple of months at a time. They didn't always understand why, but they accepted it and supported them. And in some respects, I think it makes their stories even more sad than what you would expect, because there wasn't really that much in it for them. And yet they kind of became the collateral damage when things went wrong.
That is very sad. Why do you think these folks were so drawn? Why, you know, I guess it goes down to, you know, why are we drawn to mountains in the first place? Why are we drawn to summiting them? Because it does seem for a child, especially to lose a father or mother due to this, I can imagine growing up and being resentful or angry and not ever understanding.
Yeah, it varies. It totally varies from child to child. And I think a little bit too on, you know, what age it was they were when something like this happened. But, you know, in some cases one of Maciek Berbeka's sons is a filmmaker, and he one of the things that he has done, and I'm sure it's, you know, it's probably partially therapy or therapeutic for him. He made a beautiful film about his father and his family, and, you know, just it's gorgeous. It's heartwarming to see it, and I think it was a good thing for his son to do. In other cases, yeah, the children move on to away from the mountains, and they don't want to have anything to do with them because it just brings back bad memories. In some cases, the partners, the ex-partners are sort of try and nurture the memory of their partner who died in the mountains. They start foundations to give back to the communities where the climbs took place. You know, they do that kind of thing that, you know, of course they're done in the name of their climbing partner who died or was injured. And in other cases, they just move on into a different kind of life altogether. It just is so individual.
So why, to you, is it important that these stories are told?
I think it's part of the history of Himalayan climbing. It's a niche within a niche.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty specialized, but it's a particular part of the story of Himalayan climbing. And I mean, quite honestly, I didn't realize it was as complex when I first started the project, or I probably wouldn't have started it. But it
how
is
many times do we hear that on this show? If I'd have known how hard it was from the outset, I wouldn't have done it. but it's over now.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, no, it's not over. That's the thing. I mean, I'm still waiting for K2. I was hoping that K2 would be climbed before I finished chapter 14. But, you know, there's always another edition of the book.
There you go. You know, that would have been nice to time it, you know, with this big media release of, climbing, you know, for someone finishing it or a group finishing it. And you say, hey, there's this whole book covering the history. But now that you got to wait to pull the trigger on that.
There'll be an epilogue in the second edition, I'm hoping, and that epilogue will be the final climb of K2. I mean, there are a couple teams looking at it for next year.
Hey, there you go. So yeah, hopefully it won't be too long for you to be able to essentially close this book out. That's exciting. So I know the book is out now. Where can folks find it? What can they expect when they read it? It's essentially, I don't think we covered this, but I'll say this in the intro. It's stories about these early years of climbing these peaks in winter and what it's been like for the folks involved as well as their families. And you traveled all around the world talking to these people. Where can they find out more, and what can they expect when they read it?
Well, the book is published in, it has been published in two places simultaneously. In North America, it's available through Mountaineers Books in Seattle. And so directly, obviously, from Mountaineers Books. Or in the UK, it's Vertebrae Books. Again, it can be purchased directly or else at a, you know, any, well, maybe not every local bookstore, but you can certainly get the book through your local bookstore. And that's a very nice thing to do. Or you can get it on Amazon right now. I know that it's on Amazon. And what you could expect in this book is, well, first and foremost, it is, as I said, a history. It is part of the history of Himalayan climbing and that part which is in winter, you know, a very difficult way of approaching the highest mountains on Earth, but that's what these people chose to do. But I think even more than that, it is a book full of stories about individual people who, as I said, are amazing. They're talented. They're strong. They're ambitious. They form strong friendships, and they're loyal to their partners. They do incredible things in the mountains, and they have a very complex and incredibly supportive group of people around them to help make that happen. And hopefully in the course of reading it, you learn more about some of these characters who are unique individuals, and they're funny, they're hard not to care for in the end, and that, you know, there's a lot of sadness, a lot of tragedy.
Great to end on that. A lot of sadness and a lot of tragedy, but you know that it's those stories that draw us in. It's these stories of, you know, maybe not something we aspire to do, but maybe there's characteristics, and you know, there's so much relatability, even for folks doing things that we never imagine ourselves doing. I know that I don't enjoy the cold, but I love reading stories about it and about doing these crazy adventures. But oh man, well Bernadette, I really, really appreciate you coming on the Adventure Sports Podcast and talking about this book, talking about your story. And yeah, we're going to be pushing folks to go check it out. Mountaineers Books, old friend of the show, and so we are happy to always push folks to go check out and buy a book there.
That's great. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for your interest. I appreciate it.
All right, great. Well, great work, and we'll talk soon.
Okay, thanks, Ann.
Bye.
Bye.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.